Good evening. James McCanna here with my Science Hour, April 18th, 2013. Tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking about why things look, the colors of objects in outer space. Why do they look the way they do? Why is Jupiter orange and red? Why is the moon white? Is the moon really white? No, it's not white at all. So why does it appear to be white when we look at it from Earth? So, and that brings up a whole laundry list of important questions. Why do things look as they do in as we see them from Earth through telescopes or with our eyes? Many times at the beginning of the show, I waste a lot of time, or unfortunately have to spend a lot of time, making denunciations of the, let's say, just the BS that's come out of standard science, etc., during the week. And so what I'm going to do is try and melt that down to a minute or two, because it's just rampant these days. Try and boil that down to a minute or two so I can get into the important part of the show, which is the educational science part of the show. So, but all of this is educational because you have to understand what's being thrown at you in the news out there to really get a flavor for how much effort is being put into misinforming the public. Okay, so I'll start out with some emails from listeners, and then I'm going to go into the laundry list of just absolute absurdities that have come out of the standard science news media this week. So at any rate, this one is one I actually posted on my webpage, Saturn, in fact, a listener wrote in saying that Saturn, in fact, was the only game in town as far as the alignments, and that this listener believed that I was right. Also, that this person lives in Indiana and personally confirmed the auroras that I had predicted for last Saturday. And that was on, what, the 13th? And I said, as soon as that new moon, which was on the 11th, as soon as that new moon passes out of between Earth and the Sun, we're going to get a shot, probably a glancing shot of auroras. So at any rate, this listener lives in Indiana and waited up throughout the night looking through short gaps in the cloud cover, and reports that that whole area was blanketed with chemtrails the whole day, cloud seeding. And of course, then when nighttime came, the clouds were thick, but was able to confirm auroras by waiting for gaps in the clouds, and could see the auroras, the heavy auroras that were as far south as Indiana. So at any rate, that's very important. And I actually got a kick out of spaceweather.com, who normally promotes big auroras, etc., posts this little picture from a camera, and it was a very, very, I didn't see any auroras in the picture, but maybe there were some faint ones, but apparently where the people were able to see, there were heavy auroras, as I predicted, and that was just a short shot because there were two factors. One, the solar blast that was coming by was limited and was almost already past us, and so the new moon had absorbed all of that and blocked it from Earth. So the timing was there was very minimal time. But the point I want to make is that when I looked on the GOES, the GOES satellite, the geosynchronous satellites that monitor the auroras on Earth, the North and South Pole, they showed absolutely nothing. They never showed any auroras. So clearly the right hand and the left hand can't get their act together there in Gov Science. That's one thing that's very blatant, and I imagine once I comment on this, they're going to work to tighten up those gaps where everybody's reporting the same thing. So you have spaceweather.com reporting that people in Wisconsin are seeing auroras, but on the GOES satellite data, there's nothing. There's no indication of auroras ever leaving the North Polar region. So clearly, the point is that clearly, the government is fudging data on all of these public data out, data sources that are available to the public. And so clearly they're maintaining data away from the public that would clearly bona fide my predictions and make them visible to the public, allow the public to see that, yeah, that I'm right. So faking data in satellite from satellites and physically changing them. Now, remember that this is not an easy process. You don't just go in and do this. This takes a lot of work to override the manual or the automated systems that are constantly working to bring this information to the public. Somebody has to go in and manually do this to put in phony data and put the wrong data on it, or the current data on wrong data, etc. So at any rate, the comment I made was, this, oddly enough, when you look at the NASA SOHO site that shows the satellite data for auroras, it does not show any activity at the time frame we're looking at here. This is Saturday, late Saturday, the person in Indiana. And then I talk about the fact that the satellite data is missing. Another thing is I just had posted on my webpage daily the JPL site, which is linked to the Smithsonian, where they manage the data for comets. This is the orbital data, which would allow an amateur or a professional, anybody, to locate a comet at the correct position and then all of the other parameters of its orbit. That's what I would use to calculate the orbital, the ecliptic crossing, when the comets would cross the ecliptic plane, etc. And so what we've been noticing here, and I've noticed this for a while, for example, when I first predicted that Comet Lemon would have an ecliptic crossing and an alignment with Mercury, very clearly I marked in my notes the 29th of April. Okay, so then I go back and I'm reconfirming these and looking at other data, and all of a sudden it has changed to the 19th of April. So I start monitoring this, I go back, and these are the parameters that I want out of the data. I go back a number of days later, and the 19th has changed to the 26th. So somebody is going in and physically changing the ephemeris, the data for comets, and this was specific to Comet Lemon. And then we started looking at more and more comets that have significant alignments, comets that have significance as far as solar system events, some of them very minor, some of them with other planets, finding that they are changing this data. Now, this is not natural. This is not due to new data or better data coming in. These are enormous changes in astronomy. An hour or two change would be acceptable. That would be, okay, something's going on, they got a new data point or whatever. But to change by 10 days is absurd. So obviously somebody's changing this data. Clearly I need this data and use this data to make my predictions of ecliptic crossings, planetary alignments, and other data. And so somebody is going in, and like I say, this is another automated process where this data should be available to everybody, including amateur astronomers, and they're changing it so that people cannot find these comets. Or another thing that's going on is that the pictures, for example, Comet Lemon, if you search on Comet C2012F6 Lemon, spelt with two M's, Lemon, L-E-M-M-O-N, you will not find any recent pictures. The latest picture I could find was March 5th, when this comet was very far from the sun and very remote out in the outer solar not the outer solar system, but far away from the sun and not of real interest to the public. Now that it's up in the early morning sky, first of all, the whole country has been blanketed in clouds, absolutely unprecedented, for the whole viewing period of Comet Lemon. And the this is not an accident. There, in all of the future here, if you look, I've posted on my webpage, by the way, one of the satellite infrared images of satellites showing the entire United States with cloud cover, something that is absolutely unprecedented. And then and this is not just for a day, this is for the past week and a half and into the future for the next 10 days. They do not want the public seeing these comets. They do not want the public, and I think the end game is at hand. They are pulling out all the stops. The war with Korea looks like it's imminent. They're pounding the war drum with Korea. Israel isn't getting its fair share of attention. Why all the attention on Korea? That's not a major issue, although somewhat of an issue for Israel. They're trying to make a case that it's an Israeli issue too, but it really isn't. Israel wants a war with Syria. That's the next hot ground for Israel, and they're not getting it. Obama is putting all his attention on Korea, and they don't like it. And I have feigned to say that that may have had something to do, and I don't know. I don't really know enough about this to make a statement, but everybody I know has been searching for a real reason, some kind of reason, logical reason, not the government reason, but a logical reason for the bombing of the Boston Marathon. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. I was on John Moore's show this past week, and we brought that up, and my comment was it doesn't make any sense. The only thing that would make sense is Israel is trying to get some attention so that it can get its war propped up in the Mideast. It doesn't like the fact that Obama is pushing attention towards North Korea and a war with North Korea. And, of course, all of this is fabricated in the background by the world controllers. But at any rate, there are no pictures, current pictures, of Comet Lemon. Now, do you think that amateurs all over the world are not taking pictures of this amazing comet? It's visible in the north hemisphere around the world with the naked eye. But nobody can see it. Nobody can get a view of this comet. They are very afraid of their end game coming unraveled. So, like I say, they're pulling out all the stops at this point. The cloud cover over the entire United States for a period of over 2 weeks is beyond absurd. I'll be talking more about weather, solar output, etc. A little bit later in the show. Just quickly, here's another listener email writes in, "Hey Jim, I'd like to say I really enjoyed your Chuck Schrammick interview." And by the way, folks, if you have not heard the Chuck Schrammick interview, you gotta go listen to this. Chuck was a talk show host from Houston, Texas, interviewed me in 1996. This was a whole complex era when I had been on the Art Bell show talking about the comet Hale-Bopp. Chuck had sent the photos of Hale-Bopp with the companion to Art Bell, one of the set of photos that Art had posted, and then Chuck ends up dead shortly thereafter, after this interview. But you can hear on this interview that Chuck is very lively and very alive, not a guy dying from advanced cancer. So, and he died of cancer shortly after this interview. So go to my homepage, scroll all the way down to the bottom, the extra interviews, etc. link. Go to that and listen to the Chuck Schrammick interview. So anyway, this listener starts out by saying, "Hi Jim, I'd like to really say I really enjoyed your Chuck Schrammick interview." And remember, that's from 1996. And then this email goes on to say, "Do you have any more like it lurking around in the depths of your website?" Not really. The Chuck Schrammick interview was a super interview. That what actually happened is Chuck and I were on the phone talking, and Chuck said, "Let's do an interview, but let's kind of practice it." And so we started kind of chatting back and forth about various things. And he goes, "You know, I'm at my soundboard right now. Why don't we just start capturing what we're talking about here?" So he turned it on. We had that interview. It's an impromptu interview, between Chuck Schramek as host and me as guest. That interview happened on the spur of the moment, and you can listen to it. I don't have any more good ones like that. Actually, I'll dig around, and I'm sure there's a bunch of them. There's boatloads. I've had tons and tons of interviews, but that Chuck Schramek interview is a classic. Okay, so the email goes on and says, I saw this and thought of getting in touch with you. And it's a website. It says, first test for fusion-powered spaceship propulsion successful. Okay, and this is a April 10th release from a place called Vanush.com. So anyway, first tests for fusion-powered spaceship propulsion successful is the title. And the listener says, what I wanted to know was what you think of this. Is there anything, or is this a golly gosh, isn't that amazing tier two science to be pawned off on the public? As when they start talking about compressed plasma in magnetic field, he says, my mechani-educated radar kicks in. Then it says, I'm almost certain that when new members are brought onto advanced space research teams in Tier 1, they are given a complete collection of your books and told to come back when they've read them all twice. This is signed, the listener. Okay, so anyway, you pulled up this article, and sure enough, it's just a golly gosh gee whiz Tier 2 science. They got this big vacuum device sitting on a table claiming they have some kind of a magnetic field set up for doing fusion. Well, if they were doing fusion, they would be getting the Nobel Prize because, but what they're claiming to do is compress gases to the point that they're hot enough that make a very efficient rocket. Okay, so right there you know it's Tier 2 science. It's the second they say rocket, you know that it's Tier 2 science because all of the calculations have been done. I have done them. The people in the know have done these calculations. A rocket is not going to get you anywhere. It might move you around the solar system a little bit, but it's not going to get you where you want to go in the manner you want to go. The Tier 1 science is based off what I did in the early 80s, the electromagnetic propulsion systems. Nothing comes out a nozzle. There's no rocket. There's no force pushed out of a nozzle which makes the spacecraft go in the other direction. That is not at all what happens in actual real electromagnetic propulsion systems. So clearly this is Tier 2. I said to the listener, your BS smell scale meter was right on. This is standard Tier 2 never will work science. Like the gigantic structures they are placing in the North Sea above England and Scotland claiming they're going to harness wave power. You would have to cover the sea with those monster rigs and there's no payback. They never count the energy taken to make the containers and move them there as the energy they would create, compared to the energy they would create. The second they say rocket in the article, you know it's baseline Tier 2. Rockets by their very nature are bogus. And then I go on to talk about that. So at any rate, that's the situation. I kind of like this email, and so I thought I would read it because it's really true, and I see this, but I don't, instead of blowing my own horn here, I'll let somebody else do it for me. It says, Jim, thanks. This listener says, the establishment media now has to put their golly gosh pseudoscience with a mechani-esque flavor, or it won't wash with the general public. Now that's an astonishing admission. All the blatant propaganda has collapsed, and they have to airbrush it with at least a soup can of your work to have any chance of the more inquisitive public accepting it. We have come a long way, and it's all done to your very good self-pounding away in the background for over a decade. voice crying out in the wilderness, not anymore. And so anyway, I like that, and that's really true. When the Tier 2 golly gosh, isn't this swell, government-funded Tier 2 science articles come out, they have to put a McCanny-esque twist on it to have it wash with the public, or it isn't going to fly. So they have to kind of borrow some information or terminology, but then give it that Tier 2 twist. So at any rate, that's like this listener says, from decades of pounding on these topics. A very, very important weather topic now. Okay, so sorry for taking an inordinate amount of time on these topics. I'll try and concentrate that more in the future. I should get better at that. Okay, a long time ago, when Hale-Bopp was leaving the solar system, we had a solar maximum that was very powerful, and the sun was just booming. It wasn't so much reflected in the number of sunspots, but in the solar activity, the energy that we saw, and the size of the storms we saw. We saw typhoons in the Pacific with 300-mile-an-hour winds during the Hale-Bopp era, and obviously caused by the fact that Hale-Bopp was drumming up the power of the sun on a daily basis by discharging the solar capacitor. And then once again, this is caused by the fusion of the sun up at the solar surface. Okay, so at any rate, I asked the question many, many years ago. I said, are we going to see a repercussion in the following way? When we hit a solar minimum, is it going to go down to a much deeper minimum than we had before? In other words, we had this extremely high energy output from the sun, and so the energy that feeds back into the sun to keep it moving, this feedback process, it's a positive feedback process that feeds back into the sun to drive its fusion up in the upper atmosphere, is not going to be there because it all drained away during the Hale-Bopp era. So anyway, I said, are we going to have a minimum that is extensive? And so that, in fact, is what happened. I was on the Coast to Coast show many times when we were talking about the fact that there were no sunspots. We had, a 600-day period when there were no sunspots. And this is very scary from a real-world perspective, because that means that we do not have historically, the periods of no sunspots indicates a time of cool weather on Earth. Now, we're in a period of time, and I'm looking right now at the Earth, at the temperature scale of the United States. We have freezing conditions down into Arizona, central Arizona, not just the north high altitude Colorado Plateau area of Arizona, but down into the Phoenix area, we're having unseasonably cold weather. Just north of Phoenix, still down freezing. This is extremely unseasonable. Okay, so then into New Mexico, northern Texas, and the whole United States, from Seattle south into California, swinging around through Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, up to about Wisconsin, and then also a patch up in Maine, northern, the northeastern states of Maine, etc., New Hampshire, Vermont, with freezing temperatures. But the question is, are we heading into a temperature minimum? Are we going to have a summer? And these minimums were always preceded by a drought. Gee, look at last year, where we had a drought, and a severe drought around the United States. And so now, are we heading into a period where we're not going to have summer, where we could have crop failures? Last summer, we had extensive crop failures in the United States. You're seeing it reflected in food prices now. But the global food supply cannot weather this kind of a minimal temperature. the fruit, the California, all of the vegetables and fruit from California that we need from other Latin American countries where much of this is grown now. We're not going to, it's very possible that we're not going to have a growing season this year due to cold. So at any rate, just want to mention that as something that I'll keep monitoring. And I should mention that scientists, Standard Science, I always somewhat mock them, but I have to give them credit. NASA came out with an announcement last January. Some scientists there were saying that, hey, we're heading into a minimum here in terms of solar conditions. And I read a very good article written by a very neutral person. It's just recently stating that there's two camps. There's the camp of physicists, solar physicists, that say, no, these are periodic cycles. They are natural cycles, and that it's due to solar output. No other factors, that the human greenhouse effect factor is non-existent. It doesn't work. It has no contributing factor to our climate. And I kind of mocked this last week when last year we had 70s and 80 degree temperature by this time last year, and this year we're having January blizzard conditions across pretty much the entire United States. The eastern part of the country having heavy rain and heavy thunderstorms, but the western part of the country blanketed still with snow. It was snowing yesterday, maybe it's still today in Arizona. Snow. Hey, it's April 18th weather. It's not supposed to do this. Snow in Arizona on April 18th. What's going on? So at any rate, this is something I'm going to keep an eye on, but I want to mention it to you so that you are prepared. This is an event that is unprecedented. And I think that people on the very top understand this too, so they're hunkering down. They need a good war. They're afraid to go into Syria because Russia's sitting there ready to blow them out of the water. These other countries have had time to build up their military resources. And so they're picking on North Korea, which is kind of an isolated spot over there in the West Pacific Rim region. It's somewhat of an easier target. Of course, they're talking about Korea attacking the United States. And so are they already setting up a lamb staked out in the field, some place that they will sacrifice to get the war going with Korea, to get the American public drummed up? So at any rate, that's why the Boston Marathon bombing did not make much sense. And you could see Obama even seemed to be a bit confused when this was going on. I think it was something that he did not have any knowledge of, not like the Bush Twin Towers thing where little Georgie Jr. obviously was like the cat with the feather in its lips, it's trying to hide the fact it ate the canary. At any rate, we'll see more about that. But the fact that they're blanketing the country for weeks at a time with clouds so that nobody can see the comet, the upcoming Maunder minimum, equivalent of what is known as the minimum, the solar spot minimum, and then the financial collapse. By the way, if you have money in the bank, you better quick get it out, because the United States has everything in place. As soon as the FDIC fails, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is a corporation, as soon as that fails, the banks will secure all savings and money in the bank and make it their own as a payoff of investors. It's going to work a little different than it did in Greece and some of the other countries that have gone under, or Cyprus, where they've basically gone in and with government actions frozen the money. That's already in place in the United States. For the money in bank accounts, when the FDIC fails, for that money to be simply taken by the banks to pay the bank debt. It's called unsecured creditors, and you are one of them. if you have money in the bank, you are an unsecured creditor of the bank. Because, the private FDIC is the one insuring your money, not the bank. And as soon as that goes broke, the bank's got your money, baby. And you will never see it again. Just one more quick science note. This week, for a number of weeks past and future, the Mars rover, which is on Mars, is going out behind the sun. It's on the other side of the sun from Earth. And as a result, NASA is shutting off communication with the rover, saying that the sun interferes with the radio signal, so they're having a minimal amount of communication. But I suspect what's going on is that the Tier 1 boys are using it to better understand communications, radio communications in outer space, with the obviously the interference, the radio interference from the sun, but also to understand my concept of the induced electric dipole redshift, which of course they fully understand is correct. It's the redshift. I talked about this a number of weeks ago on my radio show, but the induced electric dipole redshift is a redshift and a cause of bending of light of radio signals due to non-uniform electric fields around objects. It could be the nucleus of an atom. It could be a star like our sun. And so at any rate, the electric fields are variable, so that causes the bending of light to be variable. If NASA were a real space agency, they would be using that signal from Mars as it approaches and moves very near the sun to measure the relativistic effect, the general relativistic effect of light passing around a gravitational lensed object. But they're not doing it. Why? Why wouldn't NASA take this golden opportunity, which has only happened 5 times in the past, with the Mars rover, why wouldn't they take this absolute golden opportunity to verify and study and hone their understanding of general relativity in the so-called lensing, gravitational lensing that you hear so much about in the Tier 2 science phony fairy tale news? Why wouldn't NASA take this golden opportunity to study the gravitational lensing effect of the sun? Well, here's why, folks, because it doesn't work, because they have learned that through communication with satellites around that are orbiting Venus, etc., that the gravitational, general relativistic gravitational lensing is bogus. It doesn't work. The sun, that signal comes back, and it comes from all different angles, and it's changing. So clearly, number one, general relativity does not work. Just like Einstein said in Einstein's later years, in fact, he has a book, it's called Out of My Later Years, he talks about the fact that he himself lost confidence in general relativity. And that's why he was so ardently interested in the work of Velikovsky, because Velikovsky was pointing out historically that there was visual evidence of electrical activity in outer space. And so when I hit the Cornell and I had my work all prepared, theoretical work regarding outer space and the electrical conditions in outer space, part of my comet work was to propose that there was a redshift, which, by the way, was verified in 1986 with scientists studying Halley's Comet, that there was a redshift produced by comets. In my comet book, the new e-book Comets, I show a chart of the spectrum of Comet Hyakutake, and it shows where the line spectrum are redshifted. So at any rate, it's very important to understand how would a comet flying through the solar system have a redshift and it's not all completely redshifted. The spike is there on the correct wavelength. But then to the left side of that spike in the spectrum of Comet Hyakutake, you see the tapering off. You see the tapering off of the on the left side, on the red side of the luminosity spikes. You see the tapering off, and that's the redshift, very clearly noted there. So comets are producing a redshift. And it's something, all of these complications are things, and the luminosity of comets, these are all things that standard science cannot admit because it just screams of my work. The redshift, you can't take a spectrum of a comet without getting the redshift. So not only is a little snowball, supposedly a little snowball, producing X-rays 30,000 miles to the sunward side, as I predicted, it has luminosity, like I predicted, and it has a redshift in the spectral data. Now, why do you think NASA will not release spectral data of comets? Why do you think they don't want you looking at that green comet up in the morning sky? It all screams of electrical conditions in outer space. So once again, why would NASA shut down signaling to the Mars rover, Mars being on the far side of the sun? As the planet Mars moves around near the sun, it would be a golden opportunity to study general relativistic lensing. But they're not doing it. They're not even mentioning it. So... You know, this show is the only place in this part of the galaxy you're going to hear this kind of information, folks. Because, first of all, I'm not going to go into that. It's just the only place you're going to get this kind of analysis and information. Now I'm going to move into the main science topic. Why is the moon white? Well, is the moon white? I mean, if you went and stood on the moon, are you going to see white? Is it snowy? Or why does the moon look white? Well, it's called reflected solar light. The broad spectrum of the sun, reflected light, is white. So if there's a dust particle in outer space, or let's do it this way. You have your window open in the daytime. Let's get down to basics. And there's dust floating around the room. And I'm kind of amazed, like you, where's all this dust come from in your house? But at any rate, that's another question. But you have the window open. There's some dust there. And I notice this, by the way, on my computer screen. It's a good collecting place for dust. And so when the light shines into the window, it illuminates that dust. And it's pure white. All this dust is white. And so it doesn't matter what color the dust really is, it illuminates in white because that's the reflected sunlight. That's the key issue. The moon isn't white. It looks white because it's reflected sunlight. Most of that sunlight is being absorbed on the moon to heat up the surface. It's the moon's surface is actually dark. It's a dark, rocky surface. And that's one of the other quagmires of NASA in its moon landing, is that much of the lunar surface is volcanic, recent volcanic basalt. And that's something impressed upon us by the Russians with their study of the moon and the lunar surface, that much of the lunar surface is basalt. So it's a dark color. If you've seen basalt rock, it's a kind of a gray, dark, with various colors mixed in, depending on the mineral content, but the basalt itself is a very darkish color. So when the solar light hits it and shines out, why is it white? Now, when you look at Earth from a distance, you see blue. And if you go far enough away from the Earth, it's going to look like a blue planet. That's because the majority of Earth is covered with water. It's a blue, what we call a blue planet, something that Mars used to be. The ancients talk about Mars being a blue planet, and one day a comet came by, which they saw in the night sky. They saw this great comet passing by Mars, connected electrically like a big snake, with its mouth wrapped around Mars. Those were the auroras. In the next day, they saw the oceans leave, and the next day left it as the red hulk of a planet we see today. But NASA has their spacecraft up there looking for the water. They just can't find the water. It was there billions of years ago, but they can't find the water now, and they're trying to figure out where it went and where the atmosphere went. So at any rate, that's all tier two fairy tale science, of course. But the point is that the moon is white because it's reflected sunlight. Why is a comet white, typically? Well, it's because the majority of light, including even Hyakutake, a very luminous comet, it's white because it's simply reflected sunlight. The sunlight that reflects off something, in Jupiter is big enough to that we actually see the colors of the chemicals in the upper atmosphere, kind of like the blue of Earth. That's due to absorption. Now, the lunar surface does not absorb, there's no atmosphere, the lunar surface does not absorb the sunlight. The sunlight that's reflected is coming from the lunar surface, and it's not interacting to absorb the solar light. The atmosphere of Jupiter has a lot of sulfur dioxide, and that is why Jupiter, for example, looks orange. It's an orangish color. The same issue with Mars. Mars has an atmosphere, and the absorption at the surface gives us the color kind of a reddish color for the planet Mars because of surface conditions. But the as far as the moon is concerned, it's a very dark grayish color, so the reflected light looks white. And so the moon is not white, it's just the reflected light is white. Sunlight, reflected off the dust that's coming in around a comet is typically white. Now, let's look at an exception. When comet Schumacher-Levy 9 came into the region around Jupiter, they were white comets. And all of a sudden, as they entered that realm of Jupiter and they started forming sulfur dioxide tails, they were drawing in the sulfur dioxide gases and particles that were around Jupiter, then all of a sudden they turned into orange comets, something that standard science cannot explain, nor do they even question it. Why are all of these comets that were previously white becoming orange as they get close to Jupiter? Well, that's because of the sulfur dioxide. That's because they're plasma discharge comets. They're drawing in the tail material. And so it's the sulfur dioxide absorbs some of the sunlight, and the part that it does not absorb is the orange part of the spectrum. That's why sulfur dioxide gives off kind of an orangish light. Okay, so at any rate, the concept here is that comets typically look white when we see them in the solar system near Earth, and that's due to the reflection of solar light. When we see a bright green comet, this is due to the fact that it's lighting up like a light bulb, like Comet Lemon. The electrical current passing through the comet, now I've gone through this on previous shows, the electrical current passing through the comet is sufficient to light it up in a significant amount of its spectrum. The light that we see, a significant amount of that is coming from what we call luminosity. And once again, if you look in my new ebook, Comets, you will see the spectrum of comet Hyakutake. There's kind of the broad white spectrum. That's like a jagged line across the central part of the spectrum, and then you see the luminosity spikes, and those are the luminosity spikes that are caused by electrical currents passing through the comet, and that's what you see as a, for example, a brilliant color, like a neon sign in the sky. So clearly the moon does not have anything like that going on, so the reflected light coming from the moon is white. It doesn't have any chemical that are basically absorbing in a particular wavelength that leaves another visible wavelength for us to see. The moon's surface is rather blackish, and so white light is what's reflected. So the colors of comets and the colors of objects in outer space can be due to absorption, or they can be due to luminosity. And that's where, for example, let's look at the moon Io of Jupiter. Once again, it's that orangish color, that orangish yellow color. Sulfur and sulfur dioxide. Sulfur is a yellowish color, and say you look around a volcano, a lot of times the rim and the caldera region of volcanoes is sulfur. And so that's a yellowish color, reflected sunlight. It's absorbing all of the various wavelengths of light except for yellow, which is reflected, so it looks yellow. If you look at leaves on a tree, this is a very interesting property of leaves. If you look at a leaf, they're green during their growing period. And why do they reflect the green light? That's the bulk of energy coming from the sun. Well, the reason is if they absorb the green light, then they would actually burn up. There's so much energy in that green spectrum that they actually create the photosynthesis, creates the green color so that the plant reflects the green light and absorbs the rest. And so the plant uses all of the rest of the colors to grow. There's a misnomer that it needs green light for a plant to grow. Well, no, the plant wants to get rid of the green light. That's why you see green, a green leaf. It's reflecting the green light and absorbing the other light, because if it absorbed that entire range of the green colors, it would burn up. It's too much energy. It's got to get rid of it. So that's why leaves are green. So at any rate, there's two possibilities for the color of an object in outer space: absorption or luminosity. The reflected light then is the light that's left over after absorption. And so, but when you see a brilliant green comet like Comet Lemon, and it's lit up like a light bulb, you know that somewhere in the archives, NASA has data from the space telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope, or many of the other telescopes, all of which have spectrometers. They're looking at X-rays for these comets. You never hear about that because that leads to some pretty ugly questions. They kind of have a Band-Aid theory that it's due to ion exchange, but the people that understand chemistry never get to really ask these people questions like, well, if that's working for comets 30,000 miles out to the sunward side, how come Earth and other entities in the solar system don't have similar X-ray patterns in front of them? Because they have similarly that solar wind coming in and breaking, etc. And with ion exchange, how come other celestial objects don't exhibit this? Why just comets? Well, they can't explain that, and they don't let anybody ask these tough questions. The guys at Goddard, the Carrie Lisses of the world, don't allow these questions to be asked. They hide behind their American Geophysical Union meetings that they control and the publications where they can publish their results, and they don't have to answer difficult questions because they don't allow them to be entered into the registrar. They can control the questions. They can control the publications. They don't have to answer to anybody but themselves. They can walk away at meetings without talking. But, see, that's government Tier 2 science at its best. They don't have to answer to anybody because they get their paycheck. They're going to get their retirement, and they can do whatever they want because their buddies are doing the peer review of the articles as they go into journals. Pretty sweet system if you can get it. But that's why I'm bringing this message directly to the public. Millions of people around the world every week listening, becoming educated, because they know, number one, that Tier 2 science is being pawned off on them, and there is a level of Tier 1 science that's up there that clearly it's being divided. The good stuff for the people up on top that you don't get to see, and you're handed the garbage science that you're expected to accept. Well, I'm not accepting that for you. I'm educating you as to what's really going on, what are the real questions, why is NASA hiding data. The biggest thing that NASA is hiding regarding comets is the size of comet nucleus and the comet spectrum. The comet spectrum indicating all kinds of things. Like I say, the redshift, every comet is producing a redshift. Why is that? There's no standard reason. Standard science does not have an explanation because the comet is not moving away at near the speed of light. It's not a gravitationally significant object. In fact, according to standard science, it's a puffy little ice ball about a couple miles across or maybe 10 feet across. So certainly not something you would expect a redshift due to general relativity, that you would need a massive black hole or a gigantic galactic nucleus to cause. No. As the redshift, so there's no reason for that. And the luminosity, how does a little snowball create luminosity? Well, it doesn't. You see all of the problems here with comet spectrum. That's why I've been pounding and pounding on this over past weeks, and that's why clearly the people who are controlling weather have the entire United States and pretty much all of the world, as far as I can tell, the places that would have good visibility of comets covered blanketed with cloud cover. And then, if there were any pictures that come in, the Googles, the spaceweather.com, the Wikipedia, all of the government-controlled websites are keeping any photos away from you, the public, especially current pictures of Comet Lemon. How absurd that still the most recent comet articles, and some date back to February, about this green Comet Lemon, and those articles are out there, so they can't really pull them down. It would be too obvious. So they leave those articles out there, and that's the only game in town. Do you think that there are no astronomers around the world, amateur astronomers, taking pictures of Comet Lemon? Do you think that the Hubble Space Telescope is not taking pictures of Comet Lemon? Do you think that the major observatories and the automated search engine automated search telescopes are not taking pictures of Comet Lemon? Of course they are. So why aren't they releasing this data to the public? Because it leads down that ugly path of questions. If they were to release the real spectroscopic data, you would see the luminosity, you would see the redshift, you would see the X-rays, you would see the fact that this can only come from electrical discharges passing through the comet, charging up the comet nucleus. As I've said, all of my work proven from one spectrum, and that's why I put the one of Hyakutake in the in my comet, my new book, ebook Comets, is because it is so telling of exactly why NASA and the standard science astronomy industries are hiding this data. That's why they formed a panel to filter information that's going to come to the public. And once again, it doesn't make any sense for them to call Comet Ison, C2012S1. It doesn't make any sense at all for them to call this the comet of the century when it's out still very close to the orbit of Jupiter, working its way into Mars for an October 1st encounter. But why are they saying this when they say that the nucleus is only 5 kilometers across? I'm not going to repeat what I said last week going into that particular topic. None of this makes any sense at all. So unless they know that that nucleus is much bigger and that baby is going to turn into a major league comet when it comes around the sun, how do they, if it's only 5 kilometers across, how on earth is it ever going to survive a passage around the sun, like a million miles away? It's not. It's absolutely absurd. So where are they getting these predictions from? Nothing they're saying makes any sense at all, unless you obviously come to the conclusion they're lying and hiding data. Okay, so at any rate, I want to go back to the Maunder effect. They call it the mini or the Maunder effect, and I want to give you some historical data. This is the topic I was covering earlier in the show regarding the solar sunspot minimums, and I want to go through historical data and just kind of verbally give this to you. The Maunder minimum was from approximately 1645 to 1715. It was a period of about 70 years where there was literally no sunspot activity. Now, we are not there. We are actually having sunspots now. But we had a two-year period when there was none. But that's very typical of a sunspot minimum that could last 50, 70 years. There was a lot of death and famine in Europe, etc., that it was a time in which the English Navy was all over the world, so they had temperature records, they had weather records, and then they were actually had data regarding sunspots. The period from around, from around 1800 to about 1840 was another time when we had very minimal solar activity. Here's another epoch where it was not so minimal, but still was there. From around 1930 to around 1948. Does that sound familiar? And all of these are preceded by a drought. Then the cold weather. And that's what we had last year. We had the drought. Now we are into the next cycle. So these are spaced about 100 years apart. We, I believe, are heading into a solar minimum where we could have 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 years of cool weather. England has had 3 severe winters in a row, but of course that's due to the BP oil spill. Just want to remind you, if you haven't gotten your e-books yet, the new e-book Comets, available for $16.95 on my webpage. And if you buy the previous 5 available ebooks, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection, the Weather Book, Principia Meteorologia, and the Diamond Principle, those books are $65 for all 5 ebooks. You get the new ebook Comets for free as a bonus. So go to the webpage jmccsci.com. JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and get your ebooks. And remember, there are other items there too, like the calendar, the pre-filter, the modular filtration system. I'm out of time. See you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.